right, so I'm very conflicted about something relating to this, these episodes this week.
All right.
So, space Nazis.
Yes.
Is it better to say Spotsies or Astronazis? Because I've been going back and forth in my mind, and I think we need to use one.
Can we not?
I think we have to.
I guess I'll go for Astronazis.
All right, so Astronazis. This episode had fucking Astronazis in it, man.
Yes, it did.
That was awesome.
Yeah, it's a good episode.
I love Astronazis.
It's a weird episode.
It is.
Because it's about Nazis.
Yeah.
20 years after the end of World War II.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny.
It's, yeah. And
I don't know how, like, it's weird. It, you know. This episode, to me, really speaks to, I think, how World War II, the Holocaust, and Nazis, all awful things. Yeah. I am not in support of any of those.
Well, I am very glad you needed to clarify for
I just want to make sure, because you never know. This is released onto the internet. Oh, some yes. people don't know how to listen to things. But we, you know, we're 60 years out from the end of World War II. God, at this point, yeah, 60 years, right? Almost 70 years.
Yeah.
And so closer to 70 than 60 now. God, I'm old, but that's a side issue. But I really think that, you know, as time has gone on, these things have really sort of calcified. And I think it's impossible for us to know what the mindset of people in 1968 was like about these events. Because, and I think that this episode is a kind of a really good way to get into the mindset, because it's funny. Well, and I think it makes me uncomfortable that it's funny.
Well, the thing is, I don't think the parts that are funny, like, it doesn't, as much as I'm joking about space Nazis, it doesn't find the concept of space Nazis to be hilarious.
Like, no, that's not the part that's funny.
Yeah, I mean, they go and they find a planet based after Nazi Germany, appropriately horrifying. The jokes that happen have really nothing to do with the major situation, and they're almost kind of, they are very comic relief. Like, you have, and mostly they all center on Spock, I would say. Like, you have this great scene when, you know, they're trying to break out of the prison, and Spock comes out up with this adventure game puzzle for it. And, you know, Kirk is giving him a boost, and,
oh, yeah.
You know, he's saying, you know, all right, you know, well, and before one of the guards had whipped Kirk, and he's like, you know, my back's really, you know, bad, so go as quick as you can because, you know, I'm in pain. And then Spock's like, you know, the technology behind this. And he's just rambling about how to do it. And Kirk's like, dude, like, quick. I don't care. Like, whatever, you know. And then he's just like, you know, I don't care if you hit the broadside of the bar, you know. And then Spock's like, well, what do you mean by that? And he just keeps going on. So the humor is, you know, nothing to do with Nazis. It's just more to do with, sometimes Spock's logic is a little inappropriate in the situation. Then that's what the joke is. Or later, yeah, when you have them running, you know, when they are sneaking into the base, and then Spock, you know, says, you know, I get why you like gambling, you know, even though the odds, you know, there's still a little risk. That was pretty thrilling. And he's like, yeah, not really the time to be human at this point. Like, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of disturbing that, you know, Astronazis bring out the humanity in Spock a little bit, maybe. I think it's weird because, you know, you're right. The humor is not, they're not finding the concept of Nazis to be funny or the concept of the Holocaust to be funny. And they don't mention the Holocaust specifically. They never say the word Holocaust. They say Final Solution once. They say Final Decision once. So they use these two terms. And of course, we all know Final Solution.
Yeah.
But,
and this, I mean, the show does not make it, you know, does not mince words about what their final solution means. They are going to destroy this planet.
I think, you know, it's interesting,
but they
don't
go because, into details.
Well, it's interesting because, number one, I think the humor of it, I guess it's disturbing not because, they're finding the concept of Nazis funny, but because there's humor in an episode about Nazis. And that's not something that we would be comfortable with, I don't think. I mean, everyone talks about the Italian movie from 15
Life
years
ago,
Life is Beautiful, about, you know, that was supposed to be funny about Nazis. But aside from that, and I've never seen that movie, so I can't speak to it. But
for the most part, like, the first part is a romantic comedy-ish thing, and then the Nazis come.
Yeah, but the Nazis are supposed to be serious. Like, if you put Nazis, if you're making a Nazi movie or a Nazi episode of a TV show nowadays, you're not going to have one joke in there, and it's going to be deadly serious, and it's going to be really, really, really harsh.
Yeah.
And 20 years after the end of World War II, this episode was made, and there's jokes in it. I just find that weird.
It's a comic relief thing, and I think it actually it throws the not the the explicit Nazi sequences. It makes them even more
horrifying
by giving something to contrast it to.
Yeah.
You have this really hilarious scene between Kirk and Spock, which you're laughing, and then when you know when they're avoiding capture, you know, that's legitimately thrilling because it's, you know, oh God, you know, are they going to get through this?
And it's interesting too, because of course, as soon as they beam down to the planet, Spock and Kirk are immediately presented with a Xenon being attacked by a Nazi. Mm-hmm. Xenons, of course, being the Jews in this episode, and the Ecosians being the Nazis. I do want to say Spock's little knit hat makes a reappearance, which I love, and I just like to think that he kept it in, you know, in his drawer in his quarters from City on the Edge of Forever. But
well, apparently they have a costume department on the Enterprise, like,
well, you know, they have to. I mean,
yeah, so probably he just has props now. I would love to see,
yeah, because much later on in the episode they're like, McCoy, beam down and make yourself a colonel as a Nazi, and McCoy beams down and he's putting on his boot and he's like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, and he's like, and these boots are too small, they gave me too small of a boot. And it's like, I want to see the guy who's the prop, like, requisition on the Enterprise.
Well, they said something about the computer, like, making it. So, you know, the computer, there's some sort of, like, I don't know, computer tailor on the ship or whatever that can just produce costumes out of fabric. I don't know. But I just thought that was really the whole concept of McCoy beaming down in this cloakroom and just being like, what in the world is going on? Like, why are there Nazis? And, of course, it's funny, too, because, I think it's interesting because one of the ways that Gene Roddenberry sold NBC on the idea of Star Trek and Desilu, of course, too, the production company, was this idea of like parallel worlds. And so like they could use sets because they were like, oh, well, what if there was a planet that, you know, had Nazis, or what if there was a Western planet, or what if there was this or that? And we've already seen a couple of episodes like that. We saw a piece of the action next week, I think, or maybe the week after, we'll see a Roman gladiator episode.
And then there were, you know, lesser examples like the Apollo episode, which definitely took elements of Earth culture.
There's the Apollo episode, then they use like backlot episode, backlot sets in like Miri, Return of the Archons, things like that. So they do get a lot of mileage out of that. So this is one of those episodes, and again, it's set up as a straight take on it in universe, right? So they actually comment on the fact that it's very unusual for a planet to have developed Nazism.
Yeah.
Like, it's weird, right? And so there's this whole, like, the central conceit of the episode is that there's a Federation historian who goes to Ecosia to be a cultural observer. And they're trying to figure out what exactly happened, because Kirk says he knows him from the academy and he was one of his professors. And, you know, he thinks, oh, well, he never would have done this. This is very outside of his personality, as it would be for, I think, pretty much anyone to decide to make a planet Nazis. And so it's weird because we're trying to figure out why this happened, but that question itself is not really all that interesting.
Well, it is and it isn't, because I would say his answer does get very important, because at the end they say, you know, they're talking to him and they're saying, why did you make this evil planet? And he said, look, I saw the I saw this planet, it was, he basically says, it was in civil war, it was all these warring groups, and he figured, well, Nazism was, you know, for everything awful about it, it was an extremely strong state, it was well organized, you know.
Yeah, basically,
it had all of its madnesses, and it was a horrible genocidal state, but he figures, all right, well, I can make good Nazism.
Basically he says, oh, I'm going to take all of these sort of like strong organizational principles of National Socialism and take out the sociopathy, basically.
Yeah. So,
which turns out to be impossible.
And I think that's
kind of the point of the episode.
Yeah, it's basically saying, you know, fascism can never be for good. No matter what, if you have too much power given to one person. And again, this is the theme, one of the themes of the series. Too much power given to one person or one group will, by definition, corrupt. It has to be dispersed.
But it's interesting that the professor, Gil, isn't the one to go power mad.
No. He gets,
which indicates something, I think, about the Federation.
No, that may be, but I think it all, partially that, but partially also because then you could have, I think, having somebody else be the true, you know, evil one keeps that point of, well, there can be no good fascism. If it were somebody who introduced fascism and then himself became corrupted, well, then you can say, well, he was evil the whole time, you know, and maybe there really could be a good fascism there.
Yeah.
Having it hijacked by someone else says that, well, even if your intentions are pure, the state of humanity, the state of nature is so corrupt that it will ultimately collapse under its own weight.
Yeah, which I think is a really good point, and that's definitely there. I think the flip side of that also is supporting this as well, I think, is the idea that, and this is something that is much more explicitly talked about in The Next Generation and later incarnations of Star Trek, which we'll get to when we get to it. But the idea that humanity has sort of evolved beyond a lot of these emotions. And so John Gill is not tempted by the power that he has given himself in this society. But the people on this planet, of course, are.
But then one of the very interesting things that the episode does is it essentially puts Rommel in the mix. There is this guy who is, you know, someone in this Nazi party who is very explicitly, like, several times they almost catch Kirk and he's like, all right, you know, carry on, you know, and things. And at the end, he's revealed to be, you know, he's one of the first who's willing to help rebuild everything. And he's, you know, one of the first who's happy to find out that, you know, all right, this wasn't really what, and he's very obviously, he loves his country. He loves, you know, the land and the people, but he doesn't believe in the, you know, this ideology of hatred. He thinks that his nation is better than that. And I think he's a very interesting addition too, because that if he wasn't there, he gives the argument that no, these people went astray, but they can still be used for good. And there are still some good ideals to this. We just need to separate, you know, patriotism and loyalty and use those for good ends.
Yeah. And I think if we take that down, it's logical, historical analogy.
Yeah.
You know, after the end of World War II, there were a lot of debates surrounding Germans in general. And you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
Like, can they be rehabilitated? Was this a case of a 15-year-long mass hysteria in Germany? And you know, do you try and punish the citizens of Germany for this? Or do you go after the people who were actively involved in the Nazi Party? And of course, it turned out that in general, they didn't do much. I mean, they decided to go after a lot of the people that were involved in the Nazi Party, of course, and you know, we had the Nuremberg trials and everything. But on the whole, it was decided that the average German citizen was not going to be like irreparably harmed by this.
Yeah, I only know a little bit about that fallout, mostly from, you know, Eichmann in Jerusalem, but just what was going on to so many people was just nuts. And, you know, a lot of the people who were tried were given very light sentences. There was all of this, I was just following orders thing. And it is a very, very difficult situation to get out of. But, you know, there are so many degrees of people who legitimately were into, you know, believed in the Holocaust. And, you know, people who, you know, were just afraid for their own lives or their family's lives. And or people who thought that they, you know, would use their position to for good and would defy what orders they could that they felt were morally wrong and all of that. It's a very messy situation.
Yeah.
What I think is interesting is at the end, they're basically all saying, yes, we've got to deal with this. But they refuse the Federation's help. They basically say, you know, look, this is our mess. Like, which I think is a very interesting point because it isn't necessarily their own mess. The Federation did start this, but their point is, well, we still got caught up in this madness. You know, if it's, you know, the Federation may have given us this philosophy, but we accepted it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there's two ways you can go with that. I think number one, it's interesting at the end of the episode when Spock says he can see the Xenons and the Yokosians being good additions to the Federation, which is a weird thing to say because I don't necessarily see that in the episode. Mm. Maybe the Xenons, but the Yokosians, I don't think so.
I don't know. You do make a, you know, to have a genocidal state, you do need a strong military, and again, direct that towards good. You know, to have a strong military under the Federation is not a bad thing.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean,
remember, we're at war with the Klingons and the Romulans, you know, get the Yokosians.
Well,
fighting.
Not at war with them, but yeah, your point being, of course, yeah.
Yeah, today we're not at war. How many episodes have had a flare-up?
Yeah, that's true. The other thing I think, of course, is that, you know, you mentioned we'll call him Rommel for sake of argument, yeah, because I don't remember what his actual name was in this episode. I don't even know if he was given one. But I think the end of the episode is a bit too pat. Mm. And that's my one problem with it, where basically, you know, the end of the episode happens where Gil, they turn out that Gil has been drugged by his second in command, and they have to bring him out of it, and you get this sort of interminably long scene where McCoy is shooting him up with some drug.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, Kirk is basically slapping him to awaken him, and he gives his speech, and it's suddenly like he's saying, oh, this was a lie, and this was not how it was supposed to be, and Soylent Green is people. And then everyone's like, holy fuck, like, what are we doing? Okay, we're going to fix this. End credits. And it was like, maybe you could have expanded on the ending a little bit and not had a 5-minute scene of shirtless Spock and shirtless Shatner, as much as I enjoyed it, trying to break out of jail by climbing on each other and stuff. Like, I don't know, like, just maybe you could have cut a couple minutes out of that.
Shirtless Spock was very odd to look at. I did not expect him to have that particular body.
Yeah, I had not recalled that.
He has just such a typical otter body, like.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, and he, like, he has the, like, that, the mat of chest hair, but, like, nowhere else. It's, I don't know, like, it just has this really weird pallor to him. But then, meanwhile, Shatner has been, you know, visiting craft services one too many times.
Yeah, he's a little chunky now.
He's starting to not have this. His chest is that transition between pecs to tits. And and it's like, if you're in one or the other, that's fine. But he's in that weird space in between where it just doesn't look good. And it's like.
And of course, every time Shatner takes off his shirt, someone has to oil him up.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I guess to distract us from his.
That's what the yeoman does.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was a little strange. I mean, the end of the episode, I think, is a little much.
What? See, so where I got lost at the end of the episode, I didn't realize that. I thought that Rommel and the second in the command Nazi were the same guy.
I thought that for a little while.
Yeah,
too. It was a little unclear
because they're not really characterized either. Again, they don't really go into their names. They really don't meet them or interact too much with the second in command. And, you know, of course, they're all wearing Nazi uniforms, and so they don't, you know, at a first glance, if I didn't realize they were two different characters, I didn't separate them too.
And of course, you get Spock's great line. You propose we pass ourselves off as Nazis, Captain. That's always fun.
I don't know, but at the end of the, but I did think it was a really good episode. I liked the character of this woman who is this, you know, she's this decorated, you know, Nazi, you know, official, but she is really using her position to, you know, be in the resistance. I think she's a really cool character.
Yeah, I liked her a lot, and I think that's the original series doing a female character well.
Oh, yeah.
Because the fact that she's a woman is sort of incidental to what's going on as opposed to being necessary.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to the way that a lot of female guest stars in the original series come about, which is sex pots. So I think that was interesting.
She's not really seen sexually at all in the episode. You know, they mentioned that, you know, her beauty is not uncommented on, but, you know, it would be in any case.
Of course, yeah.
But her bravery and her, you know, all of that is. And again, she's taken very seriously. And I love their plan to get into the, you know, into the party in the first place, where they just like stroll up with video cameras. Like, that was really well done.
Yeah.
I liked that. It was, the exact level of a complexity it needed to be.
Yeah, there's a lot in the episode that I mean, it's just a masterfully constructed episode in a lot of ways. The other thing that I think is interesting to talk about with this episode is, do you think that the episode was trying to say anything about the Holocaust or about Nazism, or was it just using it as a set dressing to say some other things about humanity in general? Because if you look at it from the point of view of on the script level and in the in-universe explanation, let's say, it said that Zeo, or whatever the planet is, Nicosia, are two planets that have two different species on them that are in the same solar system, the Xenons being much more advanced, hundreds of years more advanced than the Ecosians. You know, the Xenons are a pacifist people, which is sort of put out there in a line and basically left on the table for the rest of the episode and never brought up again. And the Ecosians are said to be vicious, warlike, but not vicious, which I thought was an interesting characterization. And the Xenon character in the episode that's running around with Kirk and Spock for most of it, mm-hmm. says that some of the Xenons came to Ecosia to try and civilize them. So we don't know how many Xenons are there. The implication being that there are enough there for them to coalesce this you know Nazi government around and use them as a scapegoat for some sort of problem, which is exactly how Nazis used the Jews.
Yeah. Again, I'm
and other groups as well.
I would assume a similar percentage, let's say.
Or, yeah. Sure.
Enough.
So, and then of course, but the end of the episode is sort of set upon this idea that the Ecosians are launching spacecraft to the Xenon homeworld to destroy them, and so there's going to be a huge war.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's very different from, you know, the Holocaust, which was a massively industrialized military dictatorship intent on industrialized slaughter of 6 million people.
Of course, at the same
that are
time,
basically defenseless. So there was no state there to protect the Jews of Europe.
Yeah, exactly. And there was that's another thing. Like, there was no Jewish homeworld to bomb. Essentially, if there were, like, if Israel had existed prior to World War II, which obviously impossible, but let's, you know,
for the sake of argument, let's say it did.
You know, give the Jews, Jewish people a state, give Germany the atomic bomb. You don't think they're, you know, you don't think one of them would have hit the other? Like, I think that ending just has, I think giving it two different planets does give a different resonance to the conflict.
Yeah.
Mostly because it's not humanity attacking humanity, which is how we understand, you know, the Holocaust to be, but one, you know, it's a very different type of genocide, but still one nonetheless, of course. I feel that it's not as, we have to remember that this was meant, you know, not that long after the Holocaust. I think there had to be at least a little variation just to
make it a little more comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
let's not forget too, Shatner and Nimoy.
I was about
Jewish,
to say,
so
that's very, I think, you know, that I watched the episode with that entire subtext as, you know, the two actors and were obviously alive during the Holocaust as well.
Yeah.
I mean, very young, they would have probably been, but
yeah, they probably would have been, I think, you know, 10 years old at that point,
but still, you know, It would have been part of their life.
They would have been sort of aware of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as certainly as adults, they would have, you know, connected it to where
absolutely
they were at that point in time.
Yeah.
And I think they definitely had to have had feelings about that.
Yeah.
I don't know what they might have been, but
no, I think that's a good way to look at it. I think another interesting thing about the episode is there's a line at the very beginning where Spock sets up something that is never really commented on again, but I think it colors the entire episode when they find out exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Because Spock says that Gill was an innovative historian because he looked at history as a series of
causes
and motivations instead of dates and dates and places.
Yes.
Or dates and events or something like that. And I find that really interesting because it sort of colors the entire episode, because it kind of implies that Gil's whole philosophy of studying history is wrong or impotent, because if he studies history as a series of causes and he doesn't connect Nazism with a very specific set of circumstances, then how could he not see the logical outcome of what he was doing on Ecosia?
But maybe he could think of it as, well, because Nazism was centered around a, you know, explicitly racist ideology, and because Nazism was enacted by somebody who was the most charitable person will say extremely mentally unstable is the mildest way you could describe Hitler. I think he could say, well, again, you know, because I'm sane and because I'm not, you know, I'm doing this for unity rather than, you know, I'm not doing it unity against, but unity towards.
Sure.
You know, as a result, Nazism won't be corrupted. Maybe he, I think there's the sense that maybe he saw Nazism as corrupted by Hitler rather, and the episode makes the sense of, no, a person didn't construct, you know, didn't corrupt Nazism. The very nature of it is corrupt. There is no such thing as a good Nazi, really.
Yeah. That, okay. I can see that.
Which is a very, again, it's a very sophisticated understanding of it, just with how recent it was. I mean, put it this way, the Eichmann trial, which was less than 10 years before, was when people first started to understand how the Nazi bureaucracy was even organized.
Yeah.
And which is one of the things I thought was very interesting. You have all these people who are like, well, you know, no, you know, my orders are this, you know, and are you going, and which is essentially how Nazi Germany worked. I mean, its bureaucracy was fairly messy because you did have several different chains of command going at once. Hitler was the top of that, and whatever he said goes, which is why, you know, the Führer in this one saying, all right, arrest that guy, immediately gets followed.
Yeah.
Because you don't question that, you know.
Well, the Führer in the episode, I think, is maybe the most interesting part of it, because they do say at one point that you know, the Führer is Zenon or whatever, and it's almost, you know, Hitler being revealed as a Jew, right? So,
and I love her reaction to that, by the way. Like, she just has this, like, God damn it, you know, the little smile on her face when she finds out, like, all right. But then think about it. Hitler wasn't German.
True. Yeah. Yeah. But that was known.
Yes.
And you know, his philosophy was less about Germans and more about the master race.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of course.
Which
centered on Germany, but
and
had other.
Which Hitler was not necessarily a part of physically.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
No.
Like, the woman definitely is. She's a nice, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Blonde,
yeah.
Hair, blue-eyed, pretty lady.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's one other thing that I think we should mention in this episode really quickly. The very beginning of the episode, Kirk tells McCoy to inject some subcutaneous trackers on him.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to point out, why is this not policy for every single time they go down to a planet?
I was going to say, why is he doing a temporary one? Like,
have it all the time?
Yeah, the first thing one should get upon going into Starfleet is a thingy that you know where they are at all times, because
how many times have they been stuck on a planet and they're like, I would like to beam them up, but I don't know where they are. It's like, guys, well, if you have this, then maybe you should use it all the time.
Yeah.
But it is kind of cool because it sort of was prescient, because it's kind of like GPS.
That's true.
So I forgot. There's one other thing that I think we should mention.
Okay.
Gil is kind of a martyr for the Prime Directive.
Yeah.
Which I think is an interesting way to end the episode.
Well, because at the very end,
he acknowledges the wisdom of the non-interference policy, as he calls it, and dies. He's killed.
Yeah.
And he's a martyr for it, basically. And so he, you know, once again, it's interesting, I think, in two ways. Number one, because the Federation is set up as a benevolent agency, which has wisdom beyond any one person, right? And they're constraining the human desire and want and maybe instinct to help other people. because we don't actually know what's going to happen all the time once we help someone. It's that whole thing, you know, give a man a fish, et cetera. We all know that. And I think it's interesting as well because Kirk violates the Prime Directive all the time and uses his own knowledge to, because he thinks he's smarter than the Prime Directive sometimes. So if the show, I think, was a little more interested in examining Kirk as a person, because of course Kirk is supposed to be our hero and it's never really that interested in making him fallible here and there. I mean, we have episodes like Obsession and Court Martial, but I think it's interesting because, you know, if it was interested in that, I can see this episode ending with Kirk wondering if maybe him violating the Prime Directive willy-nilly like he does is a good idea.
It's interesting because anytime he violates the Prime Directive, he always justifies it by saying he's doing it in order to throw off a larger oppression. And that's not necessarily the case that's here. It would be because Kirk violates the Prime Directive essentially in order to stop this, you know, because he lets the, you know, the Zai whatever sold, you know, guy in the prison free. He explicitly helps to, you know, and yes, they're getting them out of there, but he is working to throw off Nazism on this planet in this episode.
True, but I think you have to look at it more from the point of view of he's trying to reestablish the previous civilization because there would be no Nazism on this planet if Gil had not gone there.
Yeah,
in the similar way to he tried to fix
Piece of the Action,
the planet in A Piece of the Action.
Okay, and that's a fair point. I don't know. I guess. And it, that does tie into at the end, because obviously if they asked the Federation for help to rebuild the society, I'm sure that the Federation would in a heartbeat, you know, sure, you know, we'll send you all our political theorists. They can help you make a government, you know. Yeah. we're gonna get a bunch of lawyers. They'll draft your constitution with you, you know. Would you like to trade with us as part of this? Well, you know, we're gonna have our trade lawyers in here, you know. But, you know, them saying, you know, no, this is our mess, you know, we're cleaning this up, because then that does directly invoke the non-interference.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's take your toys and go home.
Yeah, we don't want your help right now, so don't help us. We got this. We'll let you know when we're ready. And that's another thing that, you know, you talk about, you know, they need to wait till warp happens in order to contact. They are not ready, the civilization. Why was the Federation there in the first place, actually?
Well,
was not doing it openly.
They say he's an observer, so I'm assuming that he was not doing it openly. He didn't beam down and go, "Hello, I am a cultural observer from the United Federation of
That's
Planets."
That's true. I guess they wouldn't have known, and she didn't know that he was, you know, not from around.
Yeah,
there.
She
so
didn't realize that he wasn't an Ecosian. So
he probably had a fake story. Okay, then that makes sense. Yeah. All right.
Well, let's triple it out.
All right. This is a solid 8 triple episode. It would have been 7, but we only see Chekhov as the last shot, and he doesn't have any lines.
Mm. 8 as well for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a good one. There were a couple of minor issues, but the ones that were there, I don't think were problems.
True. All right. Well, we're done with Patterns of Force. Let's move on to By Any Other Name. Okay. So I have a question for you about this episode.
Yeah, it did suck.
Did you think, that is not my question, and it doesn't suck. Did you think that the Kelvins were energy beings?
Yes, and I was ready to hate this episode.
I thought you were going to think that.
These baldies that were, and I'm like, fuck you, Star Trek. We just had this shit happen, and then you're just like, they've got 3 billion tentacles. And I'm like, oh, well, it's Cthulhu. That's much better.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So I.
It's sort of three a curveball.
Yeah. It's like, we're not going to shoot you. We're going to stab you. Ha ha.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked it. I thought it was cool.
Yeah. It's one. But you have to understand, I picture the things from Galaxy Quest then. That's kind of. I mean. Maybe that's where the movie got the idea from.
It may have. I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But you see, if it had been energy beings, this actually would have been an interesting take compared to the other weeks, because they were saying how much they hated the bodies.
Yeah.
So I thought it was one of those, oh, that's really interesting. These are energy beings that prefer it. But not the case. They're tentacle people.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't really understand how the tentacle people could fit inside the bodies, but maybe they're like octopi, which like, you know, can...
Well, it's not like they're really like inside. They did like a brain transfer.
Oh, is that... they never really talked about it.
I mean, I assume they transmogrified.
Yeah, maybe.
But, I mean, the implication is clear that they're going to be humans and they're going to have human babies and all of that.
Well, I think the implication was not that they're going to have... Yeah, well, maybe it was. I don't know. That's the one thing about the episode that I never understand, is I'm not really sure what the physicality of Kelvin's is supposed to be like, because they don't really make it clear how they took human bodies. I guess that they transferred their consciousness into human bodies, which, where did they get the human bodies?
I don't know.
It's kind of disturbing.
It was done so, you know, yeah, it was done so long ago that I just assume that they became humanoid over, you know, millennia, and they're there. I don't know. It was generation ships. I don't really like generation ship stories.
I don't know. I thought the implication was that they did not take human form until their ship had exploded and they had to escape in a shuttlecraft. Like, why would they take human form to come to our galaxy when... They just wanted to, like, be on a survey mission, and then they were going to go back home.
Okay, I have to say, this is one of those episodes where I didn't really understand the premise. Like, I got that they needed to take over the ship to go back home over, you know, 300 years. I didn't really click on why they were there or why they needed to, but it was one of those, it didn't really matter.
There was a line early on in the episode where they say that they come from the Andromeda Galaxy, and their scientists had discovered that there were rising radiation levels in the Andromeda Galaxy that would make it uninhabitable for them within, you know, 10,000 years or whatever. So, okay. And they're much more technologically advanced than the Federation, so they can cross the void between galaxies in about 300 years.
Okay.
So they sent out a survey ship to make sure that the Milky Way Galaxy, which is the closest galaxy to the Andromeda Galaxy, would be able to sustain their life. And then they were going to go back and be like, yo, everything's cool, let's go.
Okay. Yeah, it was totally one of those, like, I was writing a note, I guess, when they said that, and it was one of those, I got enough of the gist of it that I didn't want to really...
I mean, the details of it don't matter.
Yeah, that's what
so
I mean.
Much.
Like, the details... I realized I didn't care about. They just needed to go back, and taking over the ship was their idea. And I didn't like it because they were very wooden.
That's the point of the episode, though.
Yeah.
And I think this is an interesting episode because it's one of those episodes that almost feels like it could be split into two very evenly. And you could even probably expand this into a two-part episode pretty quickly, because there's a definite division between the two episodes. You have... sort of on the planet, and then you have their taking over the ship and everything, the first 25 or 30 minutes or whatever it is. And then the last 15 minutes is Scotty getting the other guy drunk and Kirk hitting on someone and general antics.
Yeah.
So it's like tonally, it makes this abrupt shift and it's just really weird, but I think it works.
Yeah. And like, I think it's interesting how once they do take over the... They have an amicable relationship almost with them. Like, anytime any of the, and I keep wanting to say Kojins now, any of the Cthulhu beings is talking to one of the crew, like, they may have turned them all into 12-sided die, but they're having a very friendly conversation. They're just like, yeah, we're superior to you, but gotta be on this ship a while, well, so.
Yeah, that's what I like. It's like, yeah, we're better than you, but what's the point of being dicks about it?
Yeah, like, you know.
I'm like, all right.
Whatever. But... You know, the Harry Mudd, we're going to trick everybody scene was a lot funnier and a lot better done. But I like what everyone in this scene does.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that they were going for comedy with this episode, which I think is part of the point,
but
right?
There is some comedy.
Well, it's the original series. There's always a little comedy.
You're supposed to find Scotty and this dude... You know, as hilarious as
Scotty,
it is.
Scotty getting one of the Kelvins into alcoholism.
Isn't that how we, you know, the England started trade with China in the
probably,
first place?
Probably, yeah. Opium, yeah.
Yeah. But I also
like that Scotty's quarters features a medieval suit of armor in which he keeps an old bottle of scotch. Okay.
And I love that because it's like, you know, and he just keeps getting, you know, what was that? He's like, what is that? it's green.
That is a line that comes back much later.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a good line.
No,
and that's why it came back much later, because it's very memorable.
And his delivery on that is hilarious. But I love that Spock's the one who preys on emotions most in this one. He in like three sentences creates this gigantic jealousy complex that didn't exist before in this guy. And you have to think, well, Spock has been controlling his emotions for his entire life. Out of everybody, he knows exactly where the weaknesses are. So he's, you know, to this guy who's dealing with emotions for the first time, Spock plays him like a violin, and it's wonderful to watch that.
Yeah, and it totally makes sense because, of course, you know, think back to, when you first started dating or when you first started, having romantic relationships. And so you don't know what you're doing, and everything is new, and everything is like incredibly overwhelming, and you just act like a fucking idiot.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what they do in this episode, and I think it totally makes sense.
You know, it's also one of those things where, in a way, he was together so long, he never thought of that, and it took the jealousy to realize his feelings for her. That's obviously, in play here.
I mean, Scotty getting the other guy drunk, you know, the first time that you drink, you know, most people drink too much because they don't realize they're drinking too much. I mean, all these things totally make sense.
And then McCoy's feeding this guy, you know, food for the first time, and he's just like, this is delicious.
This is really good. Yeah. I love this blue stuff. I don't even know what they were eating. But
yeah, it looked like cubes of blue.
I think they served that at the banquet in Journey to Babel as well. I think that was the same stuff that the little Fez guys were putting into the cups.
Oh, I loved those little guys. Yeah. Oh, they were friends.
Yeah, but I mean, well, we're talking about the end of the episode, but I guess the beginning of the episode is interesting as well, because it's another one of those. It's kind of like Space Seed in that they're just like overmatched. Like they take over the ship in 5 minutes. There's no indication that they could have stopped it. I mean, it's done masterfully, and the Kelvins know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, they have this technology that immediately paralyzes you, and even, you know, they managed to overpower one person, but, you know, immediately the next person, you know, hits the button and paralyzes them. So it's one of those just like a, you get lucky once, you're not going to get lucky again.
Yeah.
It is emotion which brings these people down.
Right. And that's exactly what happens in Space Seed as well. And that's one of the things that's Khan Noonien Soong did not anticipate in Space Seed. And this is something that the Kelvins not anticipate in this episode, is the effect that emotions have on people and how those are unpredictable, and you can make all of the plans and you can be the strongest and best and smartest person on the ship, but at the end of the day, if you want to get your dick wet, you're going to act a little weird.
That was not where I expected that metaphor to go at all.
Well, I'm unpredictable sometimes.
What I think the comparison to Space Seed is interesting, because the two end very similarly, because it's not that they do defeat Khan, and they do defeat whatever these aliens are.
Kelvins.
They do defeat Calvin, and they defeat Calvinism in this episode.
Yes.
And in both cases, they say, look, we're going to give you a planet. Don't fuck it up, but you totally got a planet. Like, that's awesome. Like, and in both cases, you know, Khan is, you know, willing to work with, you know, with that limitations. They decide, you know, something. Yeah, you're right. You know, these emotion things make this the idea of doing a deal really palatable.
And like Khan, the Kelvins, you know, Kirk kind of explains. He's like, you don't have to do this. And the Kelvins are like, yeah, we kind of do. Like, we're not doing it your way. Just, you know, deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like Kirk is like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to have to figure out another way to stop you guys.
And in both cases, he does figure out a way, and they, you know, they earn respect from that.
Yeah.
You know, Khan definitely appreciates having a good opponent, and so do the Kelvins.
You know, I think it's interesting because, you know, of course, the end of the episode comes again very quickly, and maybe it's a little too pat, like kind of like Patterns of Force. But, you know, the implication, you know, Kirk sort of uses the idea that, well, you guys are humans and you're enjoying humans and you're stuck in human bodies and you're going to have human children and all this kind of stuff. You know, we can send a robot ship to the Andromeda Galaxy and the Kelvins can come here and hang out and whatever. And it's like, yeah, but are they going to want them to come? Because even if,
oh, that's true.
You know, even if the Kelvins do show the Federation how to use their technology to send a robot ship to the galaxy in 300 years, as opposed to, I don't know, 10,000 years or whatever it takes with, you know, Federation technology. Yeah. And of course, this also raises the question, why don't the Kelvins give the Federation this technology so they can go zooming around all the time? But even if it takes only 300 years, that's the lifespan of several generations of humans. So by the time the ship gets there and they talk, I mean, who knows how they're going to talk to the Kelvins? They're not going to, because how can they? And let's say they send a very detailed explanation of their plan and what exactly they're proposing, and the Kelvins talk about it and they say, yes, okay, we're going to abandon our galaxy and we're going to come here. And it takes them 300 years to come back. What's going to happen?
Because the Kelvins don't have the, they don't have human emotions. So they're going to say, you know, a letter from, hey, we're a different species from you, but we used to be you. Now, there's this crazy advanced technology thing that's just so much ahead of us, and they're going to help us. Here's a little ship from them. Don't reverse engineer it and make weapons out of it, but, you well, know, no, totally come and colonize with us.
No, like, no, but the Kelvins were more technologically advanced than the Federation.
Oh, I thought the Federation...
No. The Kelvins were totally more technologically advanced than the Federation. That's how they got to the galaxy in the first place.
Well, then the point is, all right, well, here's, you know, a lesser advanced civilization, and you both you've had another 300 years to get technology. Either way, they're inviting the Kelvins to go in all out war. Now that's a movie.
Yeah, that could be really interesting, actually. I wonder if there was a novel or something out there at some point that
the Kelvins coming back.
The Kelvins coming back, because if it took 300 years, yeah, it would be 600 years later. But
it may not necessarily, because I mean, one of the things that the Kelvins do express, you know, say, well, you can't communicate that far, and doesn't the Federation have some kind of way for longer distance communication?
No, they say that they can't communicate through the barrier. The
barrier, okay,
yeah.
But then they figured out how to get past the barrier, and maybe maybe what would even happen is the Kelvin technology would get them past the barrier, and then they would throw out a communication, which could be faster.
Yeah, I wonder why they didn't do that. I mean, that would be kind of make more sense.
Well, I don't know. Either way, then they invite the destruction, and that's when pain happens.
True.
So yeah. Kirk's just again doomed humanity.
Yeah, he does that a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah. Huh. Fucking Kirk.
You know, the other thing about the episode that I think is interesting is the Kelvins are portrayed as, I think they're kind of like the Ecosians. They're vicious. They're warlike, but not vicious, because they could kill everyone, but they don't. They just turn them into, as you say, 12-sided die.
Yeah, which I love that concept, because, you know, when they go and they see all of them, that you read that as them seeing bodies. But it also gives them the out for, you know, well, he didn't really kill all the crew. So you have the emotional impact of seeing, you know, Uhura dead without the actual, while still giving it an exit strategy.
Without her actually being dead. Yeah. And there's that great scene in the episode where they turned the two red shirts into, well, I guess one is a red shirt and one is a red skirt.
Oh, that wasn't actually funny, but it was just an observation.
Yes. I didn't think it was actually funny. And of course the Kelvin kills one of them. Turns out to be the woman, which I was not expecting.
I was shocked that they let the black dude live. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right, good for you, Star Trek. That wasn't a cliche yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Or was it cliche and they were subverting it? I don't know.
And Kirk is just like, what did you just do?
Well, you know, I didn't really like her because she was the most wooden of all. And her hair reminded me of Snooki, so I was not upset that Kirk did not have a romance with her.
All right, that's fair.
I love how also the lady has no shirts with backs to them, apparently.
Yeah, she was it was a tidbit nipply.
I was surprised they had that costume.
Really? You were surprised they had that costume?
It offended me. I didn't want to see her bosoms.
Well, Kirk did.
Oh, that doesn't matter. He didn't get to at the end.
Are there any sort of like broader things going on here in this episode? I mean, I kind of feel like there are, but I can't quite get my mind around what they could be. It's a good episode. It's entertaining. It moves along at a brisk pace, but at the end of the day, it's sort of just kind of there, and it doesn't really seem to. It's a good solid episode of the original series, but I don't think there's anything really there apart from that.
Oh, the thing is, it's one of those episodes that, I mean, we've comparing it to Space Seed. I can also see resonances of Mudd's Women. I can see there's several episodes that this one sort of reminds one of. All of which do the concepts better. This kind of felt like a filler, so we're just gonna. It seemed like a very formula Star Trek episode. Like this,
even the title "By Any Other Name," you know, could indicate, oh well, we've done this before.
That's true. If you want to show somebody an episode of what Star Trek is, but not show them a memorable episode, not show them anything standout, this is just a kind of. This is what Star Trek does.
Yeah, yeah.
It does it better than this, but this is a workman-like Star Trek episode.
Yeah, I could see that.
And they got to kill Chekhov for a few minutes.
That's true. They get to kill Chekhov, which is always good. And Sulu was not in this one again.
Mm. I don't know about that Sulu, man.
We've talked about the Kelvins, but we haven't really talked about them.
Oh, do we have to?
I don't know. I find
that's how interesting I find them.
I actually find them to be an interesting race because they're sort of set up as a, you know, there's a thing there where they're set up as an adversary of the Federation, but they're not really interested in being an adversary of the Federation. It's almost sort of like a person swatting a fly. They're just so much more advanced than the Enterprise and the Federation that they don't even really seem to consider that they're important in any way. And obviously, with the technology of the 1960s, we could not see what the Kelvins actually look like.
Yeah.
And we don't, unfortunately, ever see the Kelvins again. But, spoilers, if they did revisit this episode at some point, would it be interesting to see what the Kelvins are actually like, to see what their civilization is like? Because we're getting a sense of what the Kelvins are like from four or five people that aren't really Kelvins anymore.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like this, they're this weird hybrid species now. They have the culture of the Kelvins with the attributes of humanity. So that's a very – that's, I think – I don't know. Seeing a bunch of tentacle people around, whatever.
But I think it's an interesting – idea to have a race of beings that are conquerors, but they're sort of dispassionless too.
Yeah, they're very, I mean,
they're almost like ants in a way.
Well, they're not very, they very openly tell them not to take it personally. They're basically saying like, you know, I got the sense it's a, look, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. Either way, you're helping us. And look, we're going to be really nice to you. Like, we're going to have a great time on the ship over the next 300 years. Like, just let's hang out. We need people to do stuff. Do that. Otherwise, like, we could totally paralyze you and kill you with, like, our, you know, pressing, you know, a thing on our belt. So, like, this is happening.
Yeah.
You know, you're not an idiot. Just go with it.
let's just have this happen. Everything will be fine. There's no reason to fight us.
Yeah, like, look, we want a planet, and it's our way to conquer things. Like, that's what we do. Like, sorry, bro, but again, let's just play chess about it. Whatever.
Do you think that Spock, because he doesn't really say anything about their plan, he doesn't really say anything about what they're doing, aside from like you said, needling the two of them into being a little more jealous of each other. But I find it interesting because the Kelvins seem to fully embrace emotions, and they seem to fully embrace being human all of a sudden, because they realize that there are pleasures to be had, physical pleasures, emotional pleasures, even intellectual pleasures that perhaps they did not realize they could have. And that's interesting, because of course the Kelvins are not energy beings and they do have bodies, so you think that they would have that, but who knows what their planet is actually like. The other thing there, of course, is they are almost the opposite of Spock in that, and in Vulcans in general, where, you know, Vulcans have emotions, but they're suppressing them because they don't feel that they're good. Right. And the Vulcans, of course, are set up to be sort of a, you know, I think Spock at one point says that they did have their sort of warlike period and they got out of it. Whereas the Kelvins are very dispassionate and they don't have emotions, or they're suppressing them, but they didn't get out of their conquering period. And so
the thing that I think it explains is that Kelvin biology just does not support emotions. Whatever way let's theorize that there is are emotions a center of the brain or something like that. So let's say there's a clump of brain that, you know, is where emotions come from. The Kelvins just don't have that. Like, I get the sense it's physically impossible for them to process emotions. Their brain probably doesn't make dopamine. It probably doesn't, you know, make serotonin.
Sure.
So suddenly they're being flooded with this. They're essentially high for the first time. So of course they're going to have it more intensely. And I think for Spock, this is kind of more of a proof, like, see, controlling emotions, you know, because again, Spock does it so very easily. It's fairly effortless for him to get this jealousy trap. You know, that's, I think, reinforces the, see, I'm very glad, because every time, you know, if I were dealing with emotions, I would be so easily conquered.
Yeah, Spock is weird, right? Because it's almost like someone who's really good at something who has no interest in doing it.
Yeah.
And I think we all know of people that are like that. I mean, you know, people that are really good at sports or something else and just have no interest in actually doing it and just seem effortless about it. I think there's an implication there that Spock knows how to do this because...
Well, that's the thing. He's very good. Spock is very good at controlling his emotions. So he knows, again, he knows exactly everything he needs to defend against.
Yeah.
So therefore, he's been, you know, but he's constructed very good armor because he's figured out every time he's found vulnerability, I'm sure he has gone further into his meditations or whatever, or however he, you know, does control that. So again, he knows the defenses that need to be put up. He knows what defenses they are not putting up.
Yeah, really. Yeah, that's true.
So I think it's the flip side of mastering emotion. And I mean, how many times do we see, you know, things Spock does that put him into a state of extreme concentration? I mean, Ponfar, he's supposed to have this, you know, great hiding capabilities.
Well, even in this episode, he does that where he puts himself into a trance to trick the Kelvins into thinking that he's ill.
Yeah. By, you know,
and maybe, it's very easy for him. He's like, yeah, give me a minute.
That probably has something even to do with the mind melding, because he realizes, you know, because he is so sensitive to emotions, he can pick up on someone so easily because, again, he knows what emotions, he knows how to defend against the subtlest form of that, so we can pick up on that very obviously.
We're forgetting, of course, that he did a mind probe on one of the Kelvins, and maybe that's another way that he's able to easily read them, because he said that there's that line where he says it was very weird. There's like calculations and formulas going on in her head, and this is how they think or something. And it was kind of bewildering to him, which is weird because, of course, Spock is very, very logical.
Which makes me wonder, maybe the Kelvin brain is extremely illogical or
disordered.
Because, which, again, going with they're experiencing human emotions for the first time, they're not, you know, even the average person, the show is very much that emotion does need to be controlled at certain points. We see humans controlling emotion every time, you know, somebody on the ship is freaking out, you know, Kirk calms them down. And, you know, how many times has he said, like, look, you know, ain't the time, we got work to do, you know?
Yeah.
The show is very much on the, you need to have an amount of self-control to reach maturity and to get skill. So these people have never needed to. I mean, I think the only reason they're not freaking out at the offset is because they don't even realize there's, you know, that emotions exist. So they don't really need to they don't realize what they're feeling, you know?
Yeah.
They're high enough to not realize that they're high, basically.
Yeah.
And then suddenly when they're on the ship, they realize, okay, let's get them in, let's give them a stimulus, you know? And that's when their plan goes to hell.
Yeah. One other thing that I want to mention before we wrap this episode up, I think that you would appreciate the fact that there was a couple instances of continuity in this episode.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Kirk mentions, they say that they come from there. There's a bar at the edge of the galaxy, and Kirk says, oh, yeah, we've been there.
I don't remember when that happened.
Where no man has gone before. They went to the edge of the galaxy. That's how the whole thing happened with them and the silver eyes and
all
everything.
All right! That shit!
Yeah. and then he also mentions Amenior 4 from A Taste of Armageddon when Spock did the mind probe on the woman. And
I did check. That's nice. Like, and I think if the show did more of that, because it doesn't really matter what that exact adventure was, you know, we who have seen it are like, all right, that happened before. He's going to do that again. Like, all right.
And if you hadn't seen that, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I just figured, okay, at some point Spock did that, you know, and it was I wonder what that episode is. Well, let me watch it when it's on.
Well, you can't. I mean, that was kind of the thing about TV in 1968. You could not do that.
But you can now, and that's what's important.
Okay. So nothing was important until now, basically.
Exactly.
All right. So how many tribbles would you give this episode?
This is a 6 tribble episode.
I'm going to give it a 7.
You know, I didn't like the beginning of it, but talking about it more makes me appreciate some more elements of this episode. I still think it's a very workmanlike episode, and yeah, if I'm gonna watch this episode, I would rather watch this episode in a different episode.
That's fair.
Yeah.
All right, well, next week we are going to talk about the Omega Glory.
Oh no.
And the Ultimate Computer.
Ugh.
So we'll see.
Those don't sound fun.
Oh, they're fine. You'll see. We'll see you then.